Conference record has joined the conference.
We're going to begin, and let me just start by making sure we reintroduce ourselves. We have one or two people representing others, and I want to be sure that we introduce them as well. So let me start with my co-chair.
Eli Feldman.
Valencia Lloyd.
I'm Jim
Hinchel
from Governor's Office.
Betty Long,
Alan
Warren, Kate Rollins, New York. Aaron Parker, HRA. Michael Brandt, United Hospital Fund.
I'm
Holman
from
Social
Security.
John
Deere
from
the CSN.
Now I'm Kevin
Ellington, the Medical Director.
Phil Rodak,
the HR. John Chaplin, the Medical Director at Dallas
Jonathan, we can't really hear you. Can you just reintroduce
yourself?
Jonathan Kaplan, Medical Director with Fidelis Care, and I'm representing Mark Lane, the President and CEO of Fidelis Care.
And Mark is dedicating a new building in Buffalo today. So we gave him a little bit of an exemption to do that. All right.
I'm David McNally with AARP.
Kathy Shore, Greater New York Hospital Association.
Joe Healy, Comprehensive Care Management.
Linda Gowdy, Department of Health. Carla Williams, Department of Health.
And Mark Kissinger, Department of Health.
Hey, do we have anyone on this phone?
I have a colleague who's going to be joining us by phone, but not in the beginning.
Okay. Then let's begin. I think, Mark, you're going to start us off with a status update.
Sure. Thanks, Carol. I just want to go through a little bit of some background information. I don't have a slide. I apologize. We can provide some information afterwards. And talk about the man. Sure.
Turn it off?
Yeah.
If there are no slides, because the other one is just
okay. Thank you, Melissa.
Well, there you go.
All right. And Mark.
So I just want to talk a little bit about managed long-term care enrollment and the program status. Obviously, we had put a new application on the website sometime in June, and I have the experts to my right here, Marianne, Carla, and Linda, so when I say something wrong, they will correct me. We have seen a 14% increase in enrollment from January of 2011 until August of 2011, which is the latest available numbers in the current plan. Plus, we have seen application activity since the application went out. We have seen 13.
Is the mic?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you. So let me just back up. So in the Managed Long-Term Care program, we've seen a 14% increase in enrollment from January 2011 to August 2011. We currently have about 38,500 people in Managed Long-Term Care, both partial, PACE, and MAP programs. In the new application activity area, which we'll provide this in written form as well, but I verbally wanted to go over it with you, we have 13 new applications that are in. 11 are expansions of current service areas, 4 are new lines of business, and we have actually 2 brand new entities that have applied to be partially capitated programs and 1 brand new entity that's applied to be a PACE program. We've had a lot of activity. Linda's phone's been ringing off the hook with people interested in the application and have lots of questions, but as far as applications actually in the door, that's the way we have to date. And so that's kind of just a quick status update of where we are on the MLTC side. That's all I got.
All right. Are there any questions from work group members on this? Okay. Then we're going to go on to hear reports from the subcommittee that we have been involved in, as well as on the public hearing. And we're going to start with the Fair Hearing Subcommittee, and Eli, you chair that.
It was an excellent meeting. We had very, very good input. We had good participation from the ALJ area, Health Department, and the members.
Sorry about that. Okay. We had good participation by ALJ, Department of Health, our work group members, and a lot of healthy discussion that I think is reflected in the minutes that you should have gotten a copy of with your packet. I think, you know, some of the key areas that came out of it that I would underscore was there's a need for uniform public and ongoing ALJ training. You know, there needs to be better consistency. There needs to be better training about what some of these programs are that are going to occur. And, in fact, some recommendations were that in the implementation phase, perhaps the ALJs who receive training should be the ones that get to hear the cases for enrollment on the MLTCP, since we're not rolling it out on a mandatory basis in all areas of the state, and that it's much more easily controlled by doing it area by area that you're planning to go ahead and do this, and it would speed up the process as well. There was a request by the ALJ's office for enhanced ALJ staffing. I don't feel they have enough staff to satisfy demand. There was a discussion about expedited fair hearing process in order to go ahead and ensure that, first, if there is a need, that it gets responded to quickly. And we went back and forth on that because certainly on the Medicare you get a fairly quick review in terms of what you need to determine for care or not care. It seems to stretch out longer on the Medicaid side, and there was questions raised as to whether or not some of the hearings could be done telephonically, whether they could be done in the home of the individual as well, because the individuals don't necessarily have the opportunity to be able to get to the hearing location if their disability precludes them from easily doing it, and depending on weather and other issues, it tends to put things off rather than take care of it. There was an issue on the uniform assessment tool that there should be a more universal assessment tool. The SAM may or may not be the right assessment tool. We don't know what's going to be used for health homes and other types of programs that could be coordinated care programs. And so the question of having a universal assessment tool, which I believe the state is working on at this point in time, is something that we all embrace. One of the things that were innovative that I think was thrown out as a possible way to expedite this, and depending upon where you sit, this can be good or bad, is that if a coordinated care plan determines a plan of care that the individual doesn't agree with, which means that they would file for a fair hearing. One of the suggestions was that there be an IPRO review, an assessment that would normally have been done by the MLTCP program, but IPRO would do its own independent assessment, which would be paid for by the state. And that if the assessment was consistent with what the plan determined, the individual could still continue with their fair hearing process, but barring some very unusual circumstances, the fair hearing officer should be governed by the facts that are presented both by the IPRO and the MLTCP in terms of the care plan that's been put together. Question of who's going to pay for that, that's an issue, and that's one of the reasons why that was put into a parking lot right now, but I think has some very good value in residence, and I think should be looked at, and we can come up with a way that that can be covered. I think it'll speed things up. We should have more uniform service standards and evidence guidelines, and I think overall there was a very constructive and there were people here on the committee who were there. I think it was a very constructive meeting. I think it was valuable. I think the question of plans putting people into a nursing home in order to avoid having to provide care in the community puts the plan more at risk because they have to cover that cost on a permanent basis for the rest of the individual's life. And, you know, it may be that the trade-off in cost is not really, you know, that it may not be that valuable to the plan to do it. You're not really saving money in doing it that way, and it's certainly not in the best interest of the individual. Self-directed care, came in as part of the discussion, and the rights of the individual to, at least under Olmstead, attempt to remain in the community was reinforced by several of the members. But I think constructively, it was a very, very good meeting.
Okay. Let me take any questions or comments. Marilyn.
I might disagree with what you said regarding the fact
discussion about the ISPEL and, you know, and doing the inspectional review, and that evidence would kind of be heavier than other evidence that would be introduced. It was really voiced very loudly and continuously by many of us that that was unacceptable. That we felt that, first of all, it makes the process longer, and secondly, remember, someone coming in who really doesn't know the person really in the session, and they may not know all the ins and outs of the situation. I remember Valerie being very strong on this, but really, that to give that type of exclusionary evidence, the weight of that kind of evidence is not something that we would ever support. So I fundamentally reflect that there was no consensus on this. Many of us felt strongly that this is not a good idea.
Eli, do you want to respond?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. From the eye of the beholder, everything is different. And I don't remember it that way. I remember there were questions and concerns about how someone on an independent review could go ahead and make that assessment. But we were talking equally as well about expediting the assessment and doing it within a much tighter time frame than currently exists through the fair hearing process of having this thing reviewed. And I recall that Valerie and you had issues with it. I don't recall as the pushback that was received from other people on the group as you do, but again, at my age, my memory doesn't always serve me well, and I can stand corrected at any time, as my wife already knows.
Okay, all right. Melanie.
My memory is not great either, as I've proven before in this setting, but I do remember quite a bit of controversy over that issue and over the issue of any change in allowing the fair hearing officer to determine what is evidence and what is the weight of the evidence. So I would say that I agree with Marilyn in terms of there was a lot of disagreement over that point. I don't think we came to any conclusion or end point on that discussion.
Okay. Alan?
Yeah, I'm less self-effacing. My memory's pretty good. There was not agreement. I share Marilyn's assessment that we didn't reach final agreement, and I remember distinctly your comment and Valerie's. On the other hand, there seemed to be the idea that if we have evidence from the member or prospective member, evidence from the family, assessment by the plan, and we're looking to find a way to break the tie and expedite the process, bringing in. Well, the ALJ is not a clinician, and the problem that a lot of us have with ALJs making the determination, I think that in a lot of respects they're put in a very, very untenable and unfair position. They're asked to make what essentially becomes a clinical judgment without adequate clinical background, and having a third party who has the presumption of impartiality, particularly if they're not paid by the plan, and I think, Eli, the concept of payment became integral to that. If the plan is going to pay the assessor, there's a taint by the...
I agree with what you're saying, but what's not reflected is that the proposal that we discussed was that evidence would have higher and heavier weight in making the determination than any member makes.
I think we did. I think you're right. We didn't reach a conclusion on the weight of the evidence, but it seems to me that if you have and I think I said it at the time, if you have an impartial arbiter, which is what IPRO is presumed to be, if it's IPRO or if it's some other third-party entity, who doesn't have the stake in it that a plan has, the assumption is the plan is going to look to reduce and to cut because it's financially more viable. I think that's an unfair characterization, but I know that's how some people see it. On the other hand, members or applicants are going to seek to maximize, and I know that's probably an unfair characterization also, but those are the two extremes, and there needs to be a way to balance that. So the idea of bringing in someone impartial, and having a clean, comprehensive assessment ought to have pretty good weight, and or the judge ought to be more convinced by that than an assertion by either of the two sides. And I think sometimes we do get in a position where there are two sides, and we forget that we're still working towards a common good.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the work group who wants to weigh in on this or any other issue pertaining to fair hearings?
I just want to make one last comment. I'm sorry. One thing that wasn't stated, which I think is important, is that if IPRO determined that the plan was wrong and it determined that there was more care that was needed, that the plan could adapt what was being recommended by IPRO, which might be consistent even with what is being requested by the individual, and not pursue fair hearing, but that, and again, they would be on the shorter end of the stick if they decided to pursue the fair hearing, because it was not supported by IPRO. I'm sorry.
All right. Then, if not, if there are no further comments or questions, I'm going to do the report of the quality subcommittee that met on September 13th. And our charge was to determine how best to measure and advance quality in a redesigned long-term care system. And I think this is a fairly extensive report, so I'm going to try to break it down into sections. We spent some time on what the criteria should be, and clearly any of the measures need to be actionable, risk-adjusted, consistent across sectors, and have impact on care. We also heard about what we think needs to be the focus of any kind of system to really measure and improve quality. And we heard a lot about how to have measures that are relevant to consumers and that really capture the consumer experience, consumer preference. We also spent a lot of time on the issue of how do you measure and capture quality of life in a long-term system where people don't necessarily improve and get restoration of function, where you're hoping for maintenance, prevention of decline. How do we really define and capture that quality of life? We also heard from Kevin Finnegan about the importance of looking at workforce continuity and stability as a marker of quality. And I would say that there was general agreement in the subcommittee that we had to figure out some measure of worker turnover / stability in the redesigned system. We spent a good deal of time looking at what's underway today, and there are three components to that. The first, Linda Gowdy reviewed the SAM tool, and the SAM tool is a 24-page document for those of you who may not be in the blessed state of using this all the time that is submitted electronically twice a year, and I think it's used for rate setting, comparing plans, reporting back to plans. I think one of the major issues is that there's considerable variability in the SAM reporting. I think Marilyn and several other people made the point that they also thought the SAM instrument was very medically oriented and didn't really adequately capture the consumer experience and elements that would be particularly important in a consumer-directed system. A second sort of way that we measure quality right now is a member satisfaction survey. It's administered by IPRO. It actually, in 2 weeks, now 1 week, we will be releasing the results of the 2011 survey. And just to give you a preview, coming attractions, 91% of members would recommend their plan. I always look at if you would recommend your plan or not, and I think that is a very high number. 85% view their plan as good or excellent. where we fall down is in the experience having to do with dental services. The satisfaction rates are not as high. Another issue is right now this survey is done every 4 years, and the Department of Health would like to move to doing it every 2 years. And then Patrick Ruen spoke to us about the quality measurement system that will be embedded in the health home application that the State Department of Health is submitting to CMS, and actually it might have been submitted. I don't know whether or not that has transpired.
Still in draft form.
Still in draft form, okay. So if you can bear with me, in this application, Patrick said there will be 7 domains to the quality measurement system that will be highlighted. The first is reduce nursing home admissions. The second is reduce emergent care. Third is reducing preventable inpatient admissions. The fourth is improving quality of life. And I would just, in parenthesis, when we asked Patrick about how will he measure that, he said there is an index of care with information on activities of daily living and cognitive status, and there is something that measures improvements in regard to urinary incontinence, but we really have to look at that more. There's going to be a domain on mental health and neurological conditions, including depression. The sixth will be improving preventive care and patient safety. I was surprised because in addition to medication management, which I would have expected, we would also be measuring BMI. So that's a new twist, which I found interesting. And last domain is satisfaction with and timeliness of care management. We spent a little time on the data sources that will be used, and they will be SAM, the member surveys, grievance, and appeals, but at this point, claims data will not be used. I think it is important to note that New York State is going to be the first pilot state to receive Medicare data, because that will have, I think, impact for us in where we're headed down the road. Then Carla Williams presented a report on the uniform assessment system, which, Eli, you mentioned in terms of the Fair Hearing Subcommittee. And that system is being developed by a contractor, Interray. Am I saying that correctly? Interray. And it is important to note that this uniform assessment system's conceptual framework is home and community-based services. And while it will replace ultimately the PRI and discharge plan, it will not replace the nursing home assessment system, at least not in its initial rollout. I thought it was also interesting that this system is being developed from a strength and capability perspective rather than the deficiencies. It's really looking at a person's strengths. And I think the goal right now is fall 2012 in terms of initial rollout. I spent a little time because I chair the National Quality Forum effort on post-acute and long-term care, and I just recapped the core measures that we have agreed upon at the National Quality Forum, and they fall into 4 areas: function, goal attainment, care coordination, and cost and access. And I think we need to just be mindful of that. So where do we go next? I think there was concern about the number of measures and how complex this system could be. Michael, you voiced that. I think there also was concern that Helen Staub, who was here, raised about how do you make sure that this system really has incentives to continue to improve quality. And I think that's what we hope to do, to incentivize, differentiate, and really reward quality improvement. I think, Carla, you cautioned us about not just to rely on assessments because it's hard to take assessments and translate them always into care plans and meeting needs. And then I think Joe Healy said something that will help guide us in our next sort of phase here, which is we've got to take this complex system, And as Mark said, we've got to begin. We can't wait for perfection. And we have to figure out in the short term what would be an early warning system. What would we want that would alert us if there was a real quality problem? And then in the longer term, which for us is 3 to 5 years, what are the key things we should focus on that are really pivotal and that impact care and the consumer experience? So that's kind of where we left off in trying to think about how to encourage and advance and measure quality in our redesigned long-term care system. I'll take any comments from any other committee members or questions.
Carol, just for posterity, in the minutes I'm listed as not being at the meeting, but then at the end it talks about what I said
at
the meeting.
You told us to look at other states.
So I was at the meeting on phone, but it wasn't just asked us that we look at other states. There are specific states out there doing good things, and given that we brought our own Medicaid know-how in from Wisconsin, it seems like we'd be open to looking at other states. And specifically, I've been told Minnesota is worth taking a hard look at.
Okay.
So
any other states besides Minnesota that you've heard?
Minnesota is the one I keep hearing. So.
Okay.
And as Mark mentioned, you know, it may not be anything better than we already have, but let's take a look.
Okay. Thank you. Alan.
Carol, one of the issues that keeps reemerging and looking at quality is the potential for perverse incentives where someone is rewarded for having low quality and improving it at a more significant rate than someone who has a higher quality and maintains it. So I would caution that whatever system is evolving rewards programs that not only improve health and health status, but maintain it as well.
Okay. Michael.
To follow up on David's comment, the Medicaid Institute at United Hospital Fund is working with the Center for Healthcare Strategies to do a national scan of quality measures for complex Medicaid beneficiaries. These include long-term care recipients. They also include those with behavioral health care needs and the chronically ill. And we look forward to sharing the results of that publicly, and before that's possible, with the committee members and the Department of Health.
Good. Very good. All right. If there are no Jim.
We would expect to have a review draft that we could circulate to the department and to committee members within the next 2 or 3 weeks.
Thank you. So I'm going to shift the order so that we can finish the third subcommittee. And that committee was a committee that crossed two work groups, and it dealt with the work group on streamlining state and local responsibilities and roles. We have three of our members on that subcommittee, Doug, Mary, I believe you were on it, and Michael, I believe you were on it as well. So while Ann Monroe called me and kind of went over with me what transpired, I would rather ask one of the three of you who actually participated to give us a report on the proceedings. So, Doug, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to share. And also, Tom was also on the group. So anything that you or Michael or Mary want to add, please jump in. So I think the overarching principle from this sub-working group was really any type of new eligibility or enrollment system that the state works to create through healthcare reform really needs to eventually incorporate all populations, including the long-term care population. And I think, you know, we recognized in talking with Judy Arnold and David Batchelor that this sort of carve-in, that may need to be done sort of in stages in terms of which populations are carved in, and certainly the long-term care population may be more complicated in terms of putting into a streamlined eligibility and enrollment system. But again, that the overarching principle and goal is really one Medicaid system for all New Yorkers. I think we also sort of, you know, came to the conclusion that in the interim, while this carve-in is happening, that the state really explore alternatives to use and leverage data sharing in the current systems that exist, WMS and eMedMe, including looking into an asset verification system that could work with financial institutions to share data about the assets of Medicaid applicants, and also to potentially automate the spend down process by having claims data through eMedMe inform a consumer's spend down eligibility. And then I think the other conclusion that we really came to was the need for either a new work group or continued work involving consumers, providers, workers, and plans, and also state and local officials to really help guide this carve-in and the creation of this new enrollment and eligibility system for folks with Medicaid in New York. And I should also add that these sort of recommendations and principles were put forth to a vote for the subset working group, and it was approved. And our hope is sort of that these recommendations will also be approved by this work group and put forth to the larger MRT committee.
Okay. Tom, Michael, Mary, do you want to add anything?
Sure. I think that these are goals and principles that I feel are fundamentally sound and the right ones. I just want to sort of take a step back and look at sort of context. And you know, the automation of eligibility determination and enrollment systems for Medicaid is at a watershed moment. And there are people around the table like Mary, and we sat in the United Hospital Fund's boardroom on September 4th, 2001, talking about a redesign of New York City and New York State's Medicaid eligibility determinations, and then a week later, they were disabled. and so this has been an ongoing challenge, an ongoing struggle. A lot of people in the room and outside the room have shown a lot of leadership on for many, many years now. The long-term care population is different. It requires asset verification, and it requires ongoing determination of functional status. And those are not just two additional, but two additional and probably much harder criteria than the rest of the Medicaid population and the exchange population need to satisfy for their eligibility determination and enrollment. And while we're looking at, you know, a couple of hundred thousand of long-term care recipients at any one time, we're looking at 6, maybe 7 million Medicaid and exchange recipients. So I think that these principles and goals are offered in the spirit of not putting any strain on the state's pressing need to automate the Medicaid and exchange eligibility determination and enrollment systems for the 6 to 7 million beneficiaries that we expect will use them.
Mary, Tom, do you want to add anything?
I think Mike is actually very good on that point. And, you know, we are very cognizant of the strains that the state is under in terms of trying to meet the requirements of what we call, you know, the Magi population. And we certainly think, you know, that's probably the easier population to deal with. And it's certainly more numerous, but this is there are probably gains to be made here as well, but the other one is very present.
Okay. Are there questions or comments from work group members? Okay, thank you. Mark, I think you're going to give us a report on the public hearing on September 19th.
Sure, just quickly, we had public hearing on September 19th in one of the coldest rooms, I think, in New York City possible.
The
worst chairs, exactly.
That's right. You had dissatisfied customers.
That's right. Not a quality metric we good strive to, so we apologize for that up front. 27 people gave verbal testimony. The list of those people are on the website, as is the webcast of the hearing. If people want to actually go back to the hearing testimony, to the actual interchange and the testimony, is up on the DOH website. We heard a lot of varying testimony, including I kind of put into three different buckets. the consumer-directed or self-directed population, the bucket of the adult daycare program, both health and social model programs, the future of that program, and then a large bucket on the future of the long-term home health care program waiver, the Lombardi program, and you know, some very passionate talk on all those three subjects, as well as some other testimony just generally on different long-term care areas. So I thought it was a good session, and I asked people to look at the webcast if they have specific concerns or want to get more intimately involved with what happened on that day.
Are there any comments from any work group members who attended the public hearing? Anything you want to add?
Well, I'll just say what I said. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'll just say what I said at the end of the hearing. I was disappointed there wasn't more testimony about the principles, that I thought we were there to talk about what do you like, what do you don't like, how can you improve them, what do you think of them. And we really didn't hear an awful lot of that. I think maybe one or two people, from my recollection, actually headed that right straight on. Others kind of got to it, alluding to other issues they didn't care for, they wanted to support, but I would still hope that we have some mechanisms to be collecting people's ideas of these principles before they go into final form.
Okay, I think you wanted to make a comment on that.
Yes, I'm sorry. Consistent with that, and it's a good point, you did raise that. This group itself, it would be well within the next couple of weeks if we receive back any further discussion, constructive discussion, concerning those principles, because, again, as we move towards the final goal of accepting the principles and putting them forth to the MRT, to the full MRT, and going through that process, you know, it's time to opt in, not opt out, in terms of what your comments should be.
Okay. Thank you, Eli. Kate?
Yes, I just recall that there was an invitation for, I think it was Al Cardillo, to make some revisions, and I wondered if we would receive a copy of those as a group to review and discuss.
Al did submit comments that were now tied to the principles as we requested, and we could, right, we have copies which we can distribute. Any other questions or comments?
Carol.
Yes, Madam.
I wanted to echo what David said. I think that one of the issues is that consumers and families and whatever didn't have an opportunity to see the principles or know they were being discussed except by word of mouth. Many consumers don't have access to computers. And if I think that probably some of the most emotionally weighted types of testimonies we heard are from the worker's point of view and from the consumer point of view. And the principles are guiding us in where we go from the future. And things to be supported, we've done a lot of work. And if there is a way to capture that in a way that 98%, not whatever percentage of the people who testified was more of my program's important, we do good work, which no one was really there to discuss. It was more to talk about the principle. So is there a way of trying to capture that anyway or solicit it?
Okay, this is a very important issue. I want to come back to it because we're going to come to the issue of how to finalize and move our principles along. Sorry, can everyone hear me? So I want to come back to that issue that you raised, Marilyn. Are there any other comments on the hearing? Joanne?
It really does follow up on the principal's question, and I guess maybe you want to talk about it later, maybe premature, but any initial reactions from the health department? I certainly appreciate Jim's offer to the various healthcare organizations and to make some changes, but I just wondered if there was any initial reactions to some of those proposals.
Okay, so not to ignore that, because I think it's an important issue, but we will come to that when we talk about the principles, Jim, unless you want to say something at this point, which is fine.
I'm
No, we can talk about the principles. I guess we're just it's good we had the hearing, and we're continuing to clarify what we're trying to achieve here, because this is the core of what we're doing, and we want to make sure everybody has an opportunity to weigh in. I think what, maybe in retrospect, the kind of hearing we got was a little predictable, because on everybody's mind was sort of what's going to happen to my program, what's going to happen to me. And that's what we heard about. Maybe I was thinking about a principle that we'll do no harm or something like that in order to get by that. Perhaps we need to get through that. And I'm glad we're through that. We'll have the next period of time to maybe just get back to the principles and try to restate them in the way that achieves the greatest consensus.
So then we'll come back to the principles, which is the heart of our meeting today. But this group had asked for information on two areas. One was, in mainstream managed care, what are the current protections for consumers? How does that system work? And secondly, where are we with the federal waiver? So I wanted to be sure that we had a chance to get the information we requested. And, in fact, Valencia is going to walk us through both those areas.
Yeah, as soon as I can try to figure out how to get this
you
back on.
You did so well in shutting it off.
I know, I turned it off, now I can't get it back on. Power usually does it, but it's not. But if you could pass those around for me. It is on. Oh, it was on. Okay, there we go. I'm going too fast. Okay. Good morning. What I tried to do is convey the protections that are in place for individuals enrolled in managed care. And a lot of the protections that I'm going to go over are applicable to people that are in the commercial population as well as Medicaid or any enrolled in any Article 44 managed care entity, which are all of the plans that we're talking about today. So the first thing, I just wanted to lay a landscape to look at the enrollment in managed care. And this is as of April 2011. Basically, almost a third of New Yorkers are enrolled in managed care, and you can see the breakout. We have some growth since April 2011. We have about 3.3 million enrolled in state programs as of today. Consumer rights, there are several consumer rights for managed care, and all of these rights are applicable to everyone that enrolls into a plan. So there is information that has to be afforded to any member that enrolls, giving them their benefit descriptions. They have to understand the referral and authorization processes. They have to receive information about the provider network in which they are enrolling. They have the right to receive out-of-network care if the plan cannot sufficiently supply their needs with a provider in-network. There is a prudent layperson emergency room definition, basically, that relies on what the individual felt at the point of going into the emergency room to access services that requires plans to pay. There are transitional care requirements in place for individuals who may enroll in a plan where their provider is not participating in that plan, also for individuals who are using a provider in plan and that provider leaves the network. So there are transitional care requirements that require plans to continue to cover services. I think it's 60 days for providers not in the network when you're enrolling in a plan, and it's 90 days if your provider leaves the network, and you have to be in an ongoing care in order to receive the transitional care requirements. You have access to specialty care and specialty care centers. Each plan has to have a grievance and appeals process. Members have the right to complain and appeal any denials. They receive clinical rationale for their denials, and they also can get determinations reversed if upon appeal the plan does not meet the time frames for rendering those determinations. And that's very brief, and I'm going to go into a couple of them in a little bit more detail. service authorizations. These are the time frames that are in place in statute and also in the BBA. All members have to go by the 3 business days from request, but as you look down, there is a cap on the length of time that a plan has for Medicaid in order to make those determinations. So there is pre-authorization, there's concurrent, and the next slide will deal with retrospective determinations where members and providers have the right to appeal determinations. I was not going to go through all of them in detail because you have it on your overhead and it's not necessary for me to go through all of those. But I will be willing to answer any questions that you may have on any of those. So there are expedited review processes. Concurrent review is when a person is in treatment and the plan is making modifications for their treatment. There's an expedited and standard appeal. For home care, there was a new provision that was put in place that allowed for the concern that was raised was that when people are discharged from the hospital on a Friday or on the weekend, frequently there is no one in the plan to authorize home care. And so a provision was put in statute that basically says that if the person is discharged on Friday or a day before the holiday, plans have to be able to respond, and if not, they would have to cover the care of that individual home care for those periods.
Marilyn, do you have a question on this
point? Yeah. We often run into the problem where a hospital is discharging, and when you let them know, well, it's Friday and it's going to take us, and they will not do it. They'll either dump the person in a nursing home or make it really difficult. So this message is fine to the plans and everything, but what are, you know, unless you could tell someone, you know, call DOH and file a complaint of, you know, inappropriate discharge planning, that hospital's going to dump them as soon as they can.
Right. And I think we've heard that, and I think that's a hospital services issue and them discharging members. And I think the focus of this was making sure that plans covered services that are needed upon discharge and gave people the opportunity and put time frames in for them to respond. So I do understand what you're saying, but it's sort of like on the
okay.
other side, fortunately area that I'm not regulating. But certainly.
Yes, Marilyn, one of the things that will bite back this coming year is readmissions. So if the hospital dumps the patient and is not connected to home care in an appropriate way and you end up back in the hospital, it's not going to be good statistically or on a pay basis to the hospital. And most hospitals are focusing right now on how to make sure that they can make the connection properly. That's not to say that you won't get slippage. But I think many hospitals are working on that problem right now.
So lastly, plans are required to provide consumers verbal and written notice of determinations that are made. In retrospective review, there was a lot of discussion regarding retrospective. It's really, I think retrospective reviews are geared towards the providers because members frequently have received the care, and this is on the back end dealing with payment. But I put it in there so that you could see that there are requirements in place for retrospective reviews. And also, if you go down on the list, we had at one time received a lot of complaints from members who had gotten care authorized by managed care organizations, and then later it was denied at a later point. And so there was a provision put in law that basically says that a plan, if they have prior authorized a service, they cannot deny the service at a later point unless there is information that was not made available or fraudulent information made available at the time when they made the determination. And that's all that last bullet basically deals with. And also, if the person is not eligible, they can also deny the services at a later point. So appeals, all members are allowed appeals of their determinations. They have to be given at least 60 days to file an appeal. The appeal can be expedited or standard. Expedited is 2 business days. And standard is determinations have to be made within 30 days from the appeal. And again, there are time frames that are put in law at the state and the federal level, and those are reflected in the PowerPoint that you have. All members receive notices. The notices have to indicate whether the services have been approved or denied. The notice determinations, the adverse determinations, have to identify the reasons for the determination, clinical rationale. They also have to give the person the right for an appeal, identifying the appeal time frames and what information would be needed upon appeal. And what I just went through, again, is applicable to anybody enrolled in a plan, inclusive of the Medicaid population. Fair hearing rights are also sent to members at the point of a denial of care. Clearly, that's just Medicaid. And then also external appeal rights are afforded to members at the point when a determination, an adverse determination, is made. And clearly, they have the right to complain to the Department of Health. Also, in those notices, there has to be information that informs the member of how to get translation services or formats for special needs or assistance with filing the appeal. All of these things are in law, and they're a member right. So fair hearings. Fair hearings, of course, are afforded to members when there is a reduction, a denial, or termination of treatment. Plans have to administer the notices. If they're in care, the notice has to be issued 10 days prior to the action being taken so that the person can request aid to continue. And also there are notices, fair hearings are afforded to individuals when there has been a denial at the local district level of an exclusion or an exemption to enroll in a plan. So if we are auto-assigning you to a plan and you feel you have an exemption or an exclusion and we say, no, you don't, you have the right to a fair hearing, and you would not be required to enroll until a determination is made. Members have the right to aid continuing as long as the fair hearing is filed timely within that 10-day period. If it involves a reduction of a previously authorized services, as long as there is a provider order, and as long as the original authorization has not expired. In managed care, the federal government allows for a continuing to only go when a person is in the initial authorization period. So if you have authorized, say, 5 days in the hospital or 5 home care days, and you feel now, based upon a review of the patient status, you want to reduce that to 3, and that person would be able to get aid continuing if it has not gotten to the end of that initial authorization period. So if it's outside the authorization period, we view that as a new request, and aid continuing would not be afforded to that individual. And then aid continuing would be afforded if it's offered to the individual until the hearing is withdrawn, or if the hearing decision was made, or whether the original service authorization has expired. So if they say if you were in treatment till the end of the month, now if it was the first of the following month, there would not be aid continuing afforded. External appeals are afforded to each member enrolled in managed care. For Medicaid, if you file for a fair hearing first, you will not be afforded an external appeal because the fair hearing determination is binding by law. So if you have not requested a fair hearing, you can get an external appeal and then go to a fair hearing also after that. So it's administered by the State Department of Health and the State Insurance Department, which now has a new name, that Banking and Finance, I believe, is the new name for SIG. Yeah, okay. What's the old SID? Decisions are made by independent review agents. They're made by clinical peers, and the appeals are available for any denials that occur through that process. People can request an external appeal based upon medical necessity, the request for experimental or investigational treatment, or for an out-of-network service, which is the most recent area that was added. Many members have requested to go out-of-network, indicating that the services or the providers and network cannot effectively treat them. And now this is something that members can go to external appeals for. I think there is a $50 fee that can be waived. It is waived for all people that are on government programs. The plan pays for the external appeal. In 2010, there were over 1,000 external appeals, and about 39% of them were partially or wholly reversed. We have a complaint hotline that is available for members to file complaints on quality of care, plan operations, issues of dissatisfaction, questions about Medicaid fair hearing rights. 2010, there were 916 complaints, of which about 25% were substantiated. The majority of the complaints we received relate to those three areas: billing disputes, denial of clinical treatment, and access to referrals. So next I wanted to give you an overview of the rights associated with members that are required to enroll into managed care. And I'm going to preface this by saying that what I'm going over now is the process that we will put in place as of October 1. And I'll try to identify how it has changed as I go through this. As many of you know, we have a waiver in with CMS for many changes to the Medicaid program. The waiver that affects the choice period for consumers, the amendment has not been approved, but we are expecting it to be approved because we are very optimistic. And we've been working with CMS. They have no additional questions, and our understanding is that it's going through the approval process currently at CMS, and we expect to have approval by October 1.
Valencia, just one moment. Let's just take any questions now on the mainstream managed care and consumer protections before you go on to the enrollment process. Yes, Doug.
Yeah, Valencia, I just had a question in terms of, you had mentioned that the plans have the option if they need more information and it's in the beneficiary's interest to extend the timeline by 14 days. Does the state have a sense of how often the plans exercise that right?
I think that many of the plans do afford the 14 days because it's really for additional information that the provider can submit, and it depends upon the case if all the information is there. If not, we encourage them to allow the additional time for the additional information to come forward.
It would be interesting to know sort of what the statistics are around that.
Other questions or comments?
Yes.
Marilyn.
Isn't that the same for MLTC plans? The revision is a person can get an extension if the member needs it to get the documentation, that the plans are not given the extension. Is that the same difference?
Well, yes. I mean, MLTCs have to afford an extension to receive any additional information that's needed in order to make a determination. But your last point,
if I'm representing a plan and a hearing or in the process, I can't get an extension because I'm supposed to have all my ducks in a row. But if the consumer needs more time to get documentation, that is granted. So
yeah.
It's the same?
Yeah, I think so.
So it's not that the plans have an additional 14 days to get their case together. It's that
the plan or the consumer.
Or so it's either or, not like in managed long-term care where it's only the member.
With the plan can request additional time, and also the member can request additional time. And I believe
that's
it's both,
right?
Also in MLTC.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Valencia, I just had a question. There are 6 million people who are in managed care in New York State. And in 2010, you had 916 complaints, which seems like very little. Like, how should we read that?
Well, we read it as very positive. And the reason that we do read it as positive is because plans have internal systems. And we feel that most members are using their plans and are learning how to navigate those systems. Plans do report the complaints that members file with them on a quarterly basis to the Department for Medicaid. We don't receive that for commercial, but the plans receive far more complaints than we do, or far more inquiries than the state does receive. A lot of these, I'm saying 916 complaints, and those are complaints filed, but on an annual basis, we get over 40,000 calls for questions, inquiries that we don't log as complaints. But plans do a fairly good job. That's one area that we do monitor very closely when we go on site, the fact that they respond to consumers and that they log the complaints and they issue determination notices to members.
All right, Doug. I'm sorry, so just quickly following up on that, I guess what type of notice is provided about to consumers about their ability to sort of lodge a complaint with the state? Is it on notices of termination or reduction of care, or is it something the state advertises on its website? I guess I'm just wondering how consumers know to file that complaint with the state.
For government programs, it's included on a lot of the notice letters that they get, and the 1-800 number is included there. It's also in the member handbook, and it's also on the web for them to file. So we feel that they do get that information out. But
okay, so Valencia, you're going to go on to the enrollment process.
Excuse me, Carol. Can I just ask?
Sure.
I want to make sure I understand this. So when a plan denies somebody something, on the denial letter it says, if you want to take this up even further, here's the number to DOH.
For Medicaid. For commercial, that is not included on the notices. But for the Medicaid population, the 1-800 number is included.
Thanks.
Okay. All right, Valencia, on to enrollment.
Okay. So each member is has the right to get education on the plan options. We have FEs that are trained to educate and assist members in enrolling in plans. We also have Maximus, which has a toll-free number to assist with education and questions. Members have the right to choose a plan operating in the county. And they have the right to apply for any exclusions or exemptions. And this is a change from what we currently have in place. What we are asking CMS and what we are proposing to implement as of 10-1, the new applications for Medicaid have been strengthened to encourage people to choose a plan upon applying for assistance. And so a choice must be made during the application process. If the member is eligible for an exclusion or an exemption, they have to self-identify at the time of the application. If no choice is made on the application at the point in time that the member's eligibility is determined, they're given a sort of like a 10-day grace period to see if information is going to come in about the plan that's selected. If not, that member would be auto-assigned using our current algorithm for auto-assignment.
So, Valencia, a question I have is that there are times when people come into the long-term care system because an unexpected event occurs. So they have had an accident or fall, or they have a stroke, and they didn't apply for Medicaid, and they probably never expected to apply for Medicaid, but now they need to. So, and often someone will help them, you know, while they're in the hospital or somewhere to apply. So how do you kind of fold into that, this process?
Well, I believe the application, I'm not sure, does it have the Maximus number on it, Jenny? The application now has a number for Maximus, and what we are encouraging all places like presumptive eligibility providers to inform members that if they need additional information in order to make a choice, that they should call Maximus in order to do that. The local districts, if they are intaking, they would be responsible for educating the member or referring them also to Maximus. I think in New York City, there's a Maximus person in the local districts that can assist people with enrolling. So, you know, it would be upon them to call Maximus to get further information about their choice.
Joanne.
Valencia, could you explain maybe kind of some simple terms, the components that are in the auto enrollment algorithm?
Sure. Our auto assignment process for the mainstream is really not an intelligent auto assignment process. It's not based upon the providers that are being seen. It's basically we have what we call our quality incentive process. If plans have scored in a certain parameter, they are allowed to receive auto assignments. And the only requirements that we have, if a plan is sponsored by community providers. They get 25% of the auto assignment in the first year. After the first year, all plans that are have received quality incentive money from the state, we would just randomly place persons in those plans.
Carol.
So I don't know if this is the appropriate time or not, but I feel like we're kind of glossing over the information consumers need and their education. So is this the appropriate time to kind of explore that? Because I know there's not really direct marketing, and you've talked about going to Maximus, but who really has responsibility for trying to educate people?
Well, for the new applications, again, it's the local districts, it's Maximus, and it's the FE providers that are out there enrolling individuals. The packets include information about each plan. I'm not sure if it has the affiliation with hospitals it used to. I'm not certain whether that's still there. There's no, that's not provided now. But basically, individuals are told that they need assistance in looking at whether providers are enrolled in the plan that they're choosing, that they can call Maximus. There is a lot of information that's provided to consumers in the enrollment packet, and that goes out. But for new applications, the responsibility is with FE, the local district, and Maximus to do the education for members.
So what's your method of overseeing this process to ensure that it's doing what you expect for consumers?
Right. There is extensive training that's done with the local districts. We have staff that goes out and meets with the local districts. There's monitoring of local districts. There's also, with Maximus being our contractor, of course, we work very closely with them. And the FE providers all go through training in order to be FE providers so that they are taught of what type of information that they need to provide to consumers. When we used to have spot checks that we do with consumers to make sure that they were informed and that they are enrolling effectively. And since we have eliminated marketing, we sort of stopped doing that. But with FE, basically, with the training that occurs, we inform them and try to make sure that they are consistently conveying the appropriate information to members.
Okay, Kathy.
Yeah, I'm just going back, Carol, to the situation that you described before where somebody becomes Medicaid eligible because they had an episode of illness. They were in the hospital or whatever. Their plan enrollment, I'm assuming, will be prospective. So any services, even if their Medicaid eligibility is retroactive 3 months, those services are paid fee-for-service?
Yes.
Okay. Carol.
Marilyn.
We talk about Maximus a lot, and there's been large problems consistently in the city with Maximus, despite all efforts on HRA's part to try to reduce it. They don't have information in alternative media, so if someone has a visual impairment, you know, they can't read about it. If they're deaf, they don't provide a sign language interpreter. And how, if someone has a cognitive issue, or how are they informed about this? You know, it is really no consideration to reasonable accommodations in Maximus's process.
I'll look into that. It's supposed to be.
Okay, Carol.
I just want to underscore that this is really an important issue in the transition to manage long-term care because of the thousands of people that we have, and so we really have to think about those folks and how they're going to get education, because we've already seen where there's been visits to some of these people and they're confused as to why people are coming in and talking to them about a managed long-term care plan.
I guess to sort of follow up on that, if, you know, someone says, I want the highest quality plan for my aunt who now has something happening, and they call Maximus and they say, can you tell me the best plan? Like, what's the response of Maximus to that question?
Well, it's, they have to very carefully respond. I mean, Maximus has all of the quality assurance reporting requirements scored. And so what we try to do is make sure that they can provide that information to the consumer so that they don't identify one plan over another. I mean, we try very hard to keep a balance so that people can select plans based upon the information available and not be prejudiced by the FE or Maximus identifying a plan of preference. But the information on the quality scores are available on the web, and also Maximus does have that information, and the FEs also have that information.
What is the
FEC? A facilitated enroller. I'm sorry.
Once you fall,
all right, Joe, I think you were next.
I'm a little confused, and I might be the only one, so I apologize if I am. This is the current process for managed Medicaid enrollment.
Mm-hmm.
This is not yet the process for managed long-term care enrollment.
Correct.
Although obviously it provides a framework and a stepping off point. But I agree with Carol, the education process, there's a lot that needs to happen. I think, you know, the person on the street understands when they have that episode. I think the average person on the street understands their only option is a nursing home. That's all they know. It's what's been around for the longest. So there's a lot of work to be done.
I mean, I don't disagree with you, and I think that as we did the training with facilitated enrollers and Maximus on the mainstream, I think the same type of efforts will have to occur with managed long-term care. So, and I think staff is primed to do that in working with the local districts and everyone to make sure that there's consistency.
Well, I guess the other question I would have then, I can't remember if it came up at our first meeting or if it was some other meeting during this past several months, what percentage of people who will be enrolling in managed long-term care do we envision going through this process with Maximus as opposed to enrolling in the way that they enroll right now, with all of the plans competing to do outreach, generate referrals, enroll members? I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, that that's all going to continue.
I mean, I think plans will be able to outreach to members. And I don't know the weighted, I don't know if you know, Linda, can anticipate how much of the enrollment would occur from plans initiating the enrollment versus Maximus, the enrollment broker doing it. I'm not sure.
Linda, just use your mic.
Yeah. Got to put it on.
Part of the issue
is going
to
turn it on.
Part of the issue is going to be the existing population that we have to transition from personal care or from whatever other programs are coming in versus, you know, the people that you're finding the same way that you find them now. So I would think those people transitioning are going to need a lot of education, clearly. Oh.
Mary.
In New York City, there has been a lot of work done, you know, over now since the late 90s. In mandatory managed care and enrollment of consumers. A lot of the applications, the majority of applications that New York City receives for Medicaid actually do come from facilitated enrollers. And when other populations have been phased in, slightly more complex populations like the SSI population, and also the HIV population, there has been a concerted effort on the part of the district and the City Department of Health heretofore in developing materials that would help that population understand what managed care means to them and how to select a plan. I think as we approach the long-term care population, there are more complex decisions, and it's at a point of crisis almost that a person is going to start approaching this system because a lot of the people who are involved in it are not normally the Medicaid population. So you have a crisis of health, you have a crisis of financial planning, and these are considerations that the mainstream managed care plans and the mainstream person does not necessarily confront. These are far, far more complex concerns. And the decision points on whether you select, and it's not only whether you select a plan, it's what kind of plan and why. And I don't see anybody on the landscape including local districts or managed long-term care plans, who really have the full understanding of the scope of that decision-making at the point that a person is approaching the system.
Okay.
David.
Carol, I want to go back to your original question. So if somebody calls up and says, I want the best plan for my mother, what is it? Maximus won't say which picked a specific name, but there are quality indicators available that the consumer couldn't make that decision about. Is that correct?
On the mainstream, absolutely. And are they published, the MLCC quality scores? I don't think so.
We don't have quality scores.
Right, I think that's what we're working on now. Sort of that's the charge of our quality committee.
Right, so
what do we generate that people could use?
Right, and so I guess looking down the rabbit hole, well, that's not well put, looking toward the future, would an FE or Maximus be able to say, if I call and said, what's the highest quality plan available to me, they'd say, well, you know, McNally Care is rated the highest in your area, or they scored highest of all these different categories, or would that be out of the realm? I mean, how will somebody get to know this information who is struggling? Who's going to be able to get this information easiest for them?
Okay, Mark, you want to tackle that one?
Well, I could try. I mean, I saw Michael's in the inquiry as well, but I mean, obviously, the state of New York is not going to say one plan is better than the other. You know, we would never be in a position of doing that. What we would say is, here's the metrics that are measured, and here's some things for the individual or the caregiver to make a decision. And the key is going to be working with everyone in this room, frankly, and you're all leaders in long-term care, to try to make the process go as smooth as possible, and not jump into the whole market share issue among providers. We're gonna be trying to figure out quality metrics. We have a lot of experience, years of experience, and millions of people in managed care to rely on. It's not the same thing, though. It's just a framework for the next steps. But we're not going to be in a position of saying, here's our ranking of managed long-term care plans. We'll say, here's the scores that are available. People should make decisions. Here's something you need to think about.
I mean, I think the providers have been the most important factor in selecting a plan on the mainstream, and that may be the same thing with MLTC, determining what providers you're currently using and what plan has your current providers. Carol?
I was going to get to Michael, but you're not. All right. So let me get to Doug and then Marilyn. Go ahead.
So I just had a question in terms of whether the state would be looking, you know, to your point, Valencia, about the importance of providers and sort of networks. Is there any aim, and I definitely think quality metrics are important, but to create maybe sort of an objective plan comparison tool like the Medicare Plan Finder, where someone could sort of enter their information points and then it would pull up kind of a series of plans that would be available to that person, and then they could use that to kind of compare what would be the best plan for their family member? Is getting back to your point, Carol, about kind of the pragmatic, how does this work on the ground?
Well, that's something to think about.
Yeah.
And in Maryland, you were next, whether it's care finders.
It's just sort of a process thing here, you know. Sometimes the questions get sort of like, what's the state doing, you know? And so the purpose of this group was sort of to develop ideas about what the state should be doing. So I think it's really important that we capture some of these ideas as recommendations.
So to follow up, I recommend a tool like Plan Finder be adopted by the state. So.
Okay. I mean, really, that's the purpose of this exercise. I think it's a really important discussion, and it's really, I think we need to capture this.
Great.
We're going to make a set of recommendations to MRT and then to the commissioner that are going to guide the implementation of the managed care initiative. And these are the sorts of things I think we want to make sure that we carry through.
Great.
So what I'm sort of culling from all this, and I don't want to lose you all, because I think this is an important discussion, is while we're heartened, you know, Mary, as you indicated, we have been able to educate the SSI and the HIV/AIDS population, we still feel there's distinctions in the long-term care population that we need to be able to fully capture in the education and enrollment process. So that's sort of one kind of area of how, and given the crisis nature of how you sometimes enter the system, how is this, we have to figure out, we're recommending that the education system process somehow accommodate and address that. So we want to capture that recommendation. And then I want to not lose sight of that other recommendation, Mark, you're pointing out there is going to be some kind of scorecard that people can use. We're not going to have U.S. News and World Report rankings yet. But we are going to have some scorecard. If the quality committee can do its work, we should be able to have some things that will be available to guide consumers. So is everyone comfortable with recommendations in those two areas?
Can I just tweak that a little bit?
Tweak.
Okay. Quality should also include plant expertise and population. So if you're calling because your 21-year-old son had a spinal cord injury and is now going to go into a plan, the plan you'll be looking for may be something different than a plan that has expertise working with seniors who may have cognitive issues or whatever. So in this point of crisis, when someone is newly, something happens and they have to make these, your life changes in a second, your whole family's life and everything. And you're in that hospital and they're trying to get you out. And the social worker is saying, well, if you can't do this, you're going to go to a nursing home. Or and your daughter can't, you know, your mother can't take the time off to give you the care while all this is working.
Well,
or
we had a principal having to do with special populations,
right,
and
so,
special expertise.
Right. So what,
right.
What I'm saying that is that I think that what, and I agree definitely with Mark in that type of pull down the questions you asked based on where you live, what your situation is, and what your what you expect. And I think it's really hard for people coming into this system in a point of crisis to make any reasonable or a decision. You know, they may choose whoever they talk to sound the nicest on the phone when they call the different plans or who didn't put them on hold, you know, and there has to be some kind of protection in when someone enrolls that, you know, they could opt out easily because, gee, I didn't have all this information.
Yeah,
you know.
Yes.
Can I come?
Eli, yes.
Marilyn, I think one of the problems is we haven't given Valencia the opportunity to go through the rest of the material because one of the things the individual does have, if they did make the incorrect selection, is 90 days to opt out of the plan and transfer to another plan. So it's not like I pick the plan, that's it, you finish. They have an opportunity to go ahead and say, oh, wait, maybe I didn't make the right choice, or at the time I was under a lot of pressure to go ahead and figure this out.
But what's going on to expedite that, to facilitate that informed decision? I think that's what most of us are saying. What? Carol, you said it.
All
you know.
Right, so we have two recommendations. I just, you know, had stopped before because I got an email from someone who's in television, who's like very sophisticated, saying, my mother needs to go to a nursing home today. What should I do? You know? And you think people have a knowledge base, and you keep being reminded that they often don't have a knowledge base who's trying to help them, and we have to figure out how we have a viable education process that's going to work. And so we're going to have a recommendation on that as well as on the quality scorecard. Is there anyone who's not comfortable endorsing those two recommendations? Betty, are you uncomfortable?
I'm not uncomfortable. I would just like to add on to Doug's comment.
Okay.
You know, I think the pull-down data that tells me that the different types of plans and what their performance is in certain areas needs to be current. You know, not every 4 years do we upgrade it, update it, so that there needs to be an expectation that, I don't know, annually or somehow, or that has to be refreshed so that it is appropriate for people to make decisions.
Currently, our data is an annual lag.
Okay.
So members would be able to see now 2010 performance and follow to that.
I think just as a note, an awful lot of people enter this system
the long-term care system enter through rehab services. And as a point of education, rehab in either the nursing home or home care environment provides an opportunity for education.
Okay, so I'm assuming that these two recommendations will be crafted and we will bring them back for final endorsement. And Valencia, continue.
Okay. I just want to add, Marilyn, in response to what you were saying before with Maximus, as you know, we are just in the process of renewing our contract with Maximus. And Jenny just gave me a note that they do have language translation lines. They do have lines for the hearing impaired now, and they have information on CDs. And they've worked with Lighthouse and to advise them on how to deal with people more effectively in an electronic manner. So you let me know if that's not happening. Okay. All right, so we went through new applications. And so now we're looking at individuals who are currently on Medicaid that are being targeted, new populations that are enrolling in mainstream. We are constantly adding new mandatory counties, and so when new populations and mandatory counties are occurring, members will receive enrollment packets, and again, those enrollment packets will have information and will encourage members, once we get the waiver beginning October 1, that they have 30 days to choose a plan. And they will have the information in there, and they can choose a plan by mail, by phone, or by going in person to the local district. If they do not choose a plan within that 30-day period, we will auto-assign them to a plan if they are in a mandatory county.
Can I ask a question
about the auto-enrollment? Sure. Jay, just put on your mic. Shall I ask a question now about the auto-enrollment, or should I wait till you...
Yeah, this is fine.
I just wanted to ask, what processes are currently in place, or what do we foresee as having auto-enrollment being... kind of intelligent. So it's not just everybody gets one, but going back to Marilyn's point that if somebody's really has a specific need, there may be a plan that is better for them than just kind of randomly assigning them. Is that currently the process, or what? How is auto-enrollment take care of that issue?
As I indicated, you know, we've gotten a lot of criticisms about not having an intelligent auto-assignment process, and we've looked into it several times, and part of our challenge has been when we look at members, they utilize a wide array of providers. And so we didn't want, it's difficult for us to determine which provider is the most important provider to that individual, because if you're in ongoing treatment with a specialty provider, your PCP may not be your best the provider that you would want to use to elect your plan. It may be your cardiologist, it may be, you know, another provider. And so that was the challenge that we had to determine which provider we should use in order to transition a person into plan. And therefore, since we couldn't really come up with any algorithm, and in speaking to people, no one really could give us, I guess, parameters as to which providers would be the most important to individuals, we do randomly place people into the plans that receive the quality scores. However, as Eli mentioned, members do, one of the benefits of enrolling in managed care mainstream is that you do get guaranteed eligibility for a six-month period, regardless of whether your income changes or not. You're locked in after the first 90 days. So if you elect a plan and you get in that plan and for whatever reason you don't feel that it can provide the services that you need, you can change to another plan for any reason within the first 90 days, but after that, you're locked in for 9 months. And after that first year, you can change plans to the extent that you would like. The only exception that we have to that is the HIV population. We allow individuals to change from a mainstream program into an HIV SNP at any time.
Valencia, one other question I have is if you have someone who's going to be in a health home, how is that health home going to intercept if that person ends up needing long-term care services for more than 120 days?
Very good question, and one that we are still working on. A lot of issues relating to the health home has not been worked out yet. I do think that the only thing I will say about health homes, for people that are enrolled in plans,
the health homes will still need to utilize in-plan providers to provide care. They will still need to utilize the internal processes for authorizations of care. We're encouraging plans to make sure that if they elect a health home provider, that those providers or that network is part of their main network so that it can avoid any conflict on in and out of network care. But the whole aspect of how the health home will work, especially relating to managed long-term care, has not been worked out yet.
Michael.
Thank you, Michael, and your check will be at the door.
That is an excellent point. What is the percentage now that end up being auto-enrolled?
New York City's auto-assignment rate, I think it's like 12 or 14% at this point in time. It's very, very low. And we have a process of monitoring auto-assignments, so if we go into counties and they have high auto-assignment rates, we actually will, and high is, I think it's 20% or higher, we put them on watch, and if they get to 30%, we actually suspend the auto assignment until the county does a better job in outreaching. But again, when working with HRA in New York City, they've done a fabulous job of working with the state in a very collaborative way in order for us to keep the auto assignment rate very low.
On the numbers here, a caveat, it's not apples to oranges. This is 10 or 12% auto assignment in a population, many of whom have not needed to go to a medical provider for a long, long time. So that's not to say that we'd be happy with 12% of the long care population. It's to say that if you look at the mainstream Medicare trend, it's much larger.
Jim.
Yeah, we're talking managed long-term care here, and I think the relationship with the provider is oftentimes more intense, more comprehensive, and the provider association ought to be a critical factor in that. I think it's, again, as we are beginning to think about future and recommendations, and I'm not sure how much we've talked here about assuring continuity of providers as we begin to transfer people into the managed long-term care framework, but I think it's an important issue of trying to support the continuity of providers and driving enrollment on the basis of the associations between the plans and the providers.
Kathy.
So I wanted to give some credit to the department because the criteria for auto assignment is actually in statute, and it was negotiated, well, probably 20 years ago. But one of the criteria that the state can consider in auto assigning is the cost of the plan, and they have never done that. So I think that's a good point to remember.
Carol. I do want to just hold on to this issue of assuring continuity of provider because today we're going to take a look at the principles and how we move towards the next step of our embracing and taking ownership of principles. But we also will need to come up with some key guidelines for transition. And I want to just hold on to this issue if one of our key guidelines will include assuring continuity of providers to the extent possible. There has to be some contingency there. So I'm just going to make sure we come back around to that issue as well.
Carol, yes. Just to tweak it, the one concern is that many people with disabilities, as I assume many other people for chronic conditions, get their most of their care at academic hospital-based clinics where there is no continuity of the provider. The issue but reaching out and establishing good primary care for our population is a huge issue. So that when you look at provider and when you look at evolving into medical homes and things like that, we really have to look at the other side, the provider side, in terms of the person may not really be the best person who knows about it because they're seen in the clinic by the resident du jour every time they go there.
Okay, Betty. My comment is similar to Marilyn's. You know, and again, I know the primary drive is not around dual eligibles, it's around Medicaid only as a first blush. But, you know, if you have somebody who's auto-assigned a doc and they're in a nursing home and that doc doesn't go to the nursing home, what have you served? And so I don't know how you screen that whole process.
Okay, Valencia, back to you, and I'm going to ask you to try to wrap up this part.
We're pretty much done. The only other thing I was going to say is that people have the right to choose a PCP. If they don't in managed care, they do get assigned a primary care provider because everyone in managed care has to have a primary care provider in mainstream. However, they can change PCPs if they do not like the one that they're assigned to. And I already indicated the right to pay a hearing.
Okay.
So we're done with that.
All right. So I would like to do the following. I'd like to go on to the waiver request. Then I'd like to see if we can break for a short lunch and then come back and work on the principles. Okay.
So,
Valencia, I think you're on for the waiver request
okay.
as well.
So what I provided everyone is a brief summary of the 1115 waiver. Hopefully it has been handed out. I'm just going to touch on some high points. I thought it would be more helpful to give a very expanded narrative of what the 1115 waiver is to New York State and what we have accomplished through that waiver. However, just in general, the waiver, 1115 waiver, allows the state to implement demonstration programs that would not otherwise be covered by the federal government. Clearly, there are two areas that can be waived. It allows the state to waive statewideness, and we needed that because each county was not mandatory at one time. There was variation throughout the state. Freedom of choice to require people to enroll in managed care in order to continue receiving benefits. And the Medicaid eligibility and quality control is how we monitor and how we establish eligibility for individuals. We also got a waiver relating to services that would not otherwise be covered by CMS included in our waiver. So New York State basically has both aspects of the 1115 waiver, has requested waivers of all of those areas in order to implement the mainstream program. We've been working under the partnership plan since 1997. There are several programs that have been implemented, namely the Family Health Plus program. We have the Family Planning Benefit program for individuals who would not otherwise be eligible. We were allowed to enroll the SSI population through the waiver. The other important aspect of the waiver is that the waiver has to be budget neutral, and that's budget neutral to CMS, meaning that the programs that we have under the waiver cannot cost more than it would if we did not have the waiver. So each population that we move into the waiver, we have to show budget neutrality. CMS gives us a PMPM for individuals coming in, and basically what we do is apply that to the actual cost of the person in the waiver. So we have a with waiver and a without waiver amount. At this point in time, the state has about $31 billion banked on the partnership plan waiver, and every time I say that, people get excited, but if you talk to CMS, they will clearly tell you it's not like you have a bank account and that you can draw down and use that money for other programs. But basically what that means is that we have, over the life of our waiver, presumably based upon the PMPMs that we started with and that have been trended forward, we have saved CMS and the state approximately $31 billion for administering Medicaid. The other aspect of the waivers are that there are state-designated programs that CMS did not give federal participating dollars to.
we have identified several programs, tobacco screening, newborn screening, public health initiatives, many programs that CMS, through our waiver process, has agreed to give us federal participating dollars. We're able then to use those dollars to support other program initiatives. And that's pretty much a very brief outline of what the waiver has meant to the state. And again, the narrative sort of lays out it more clearly. And if you have any questions about the waiver, I'm more than willing to answer those.
Valencia, you said that we saved the federal government $31 billion.
On paper.
And do we have any estimate of what we could save the federal government if they agree to our request?
That actually is part of the negotiations, and we haven't gotten to that point yet with CMS. I'm assuming they're going to give us different PMPMs for this population, but, you know, we haven't started discussing the amendment to go mandatory with MLCC. Actually, we're supposed to begin that discussion after we get the approval of the 10-1 initiative.
And has CMS approved mandatory enrollment for a long-term care Medicaid population in other states?
Yes, they have. Other states have done it in varying ways. Some have done it by expanding the mainstream benefit package, which we're doing also for the non-duals. Others have implemented programs specific to that population, and they have approved those. So we're encouraged that they will approve it, but.
Okay. The amendments of West Atlanta is that, you know, unlike the Medicaid acute care benefit, it only varies a little bit from state to state. The long-term care benefit varies dramatically from state to state. The CMS is going to be not on totally new ground, but on pretty new ground here just by virtue of the fact that New York has a new
So can you amplify that? You said that the program can.
Your question has CMS approved mandatory long
term care
in the states before, and the blunted answer is totally correct. Yes, they have, but not the states that necessarily have the same type of long term care benefit under Medicaid that New York is.
Okay. All right, Joe.
And are you talking with them about having dual eligible programs be among the options available for mandatory enrollment, i.e. MAP and PACE?
When we get into those discussions, the amendment that we submitted did include all of the program line of businesses that exist for managed long-term care.
Kathy.
That one of the challenges is going to be, because so many of these individuals are dually eligible, budget neutrality is potentially an issue, because they will not allow you to count Medicare savings in an 1115 waiver to meet budget neutrality. So the savings actually have to come on the Medicaid side. So you're providing maybe more long-term care services and services in the community, plus care management, and you have to do it in a budget neutral way.
That is a challenge.
Is the waiver and the narrative online somewhere, or the application, or what else can we see besides the three pages?
Yes, the waiver is on the web, and the amendment is also on the web.
Okay. Are there other questions about the waiver?
Okay.
So I don't know if lunch has arrived.
All of our orders.
I'm sorry,
email
is
all
the
here.
Okay.
Okay, I'm sorry. So the waiver, this describes what waiver we currently have.
Correct.
But we're applying for a new waiver.
Well, no, it's an amendment to this waiver.
It's an amendment to this waiver. So the amendment to this waiver is also online.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
It does not have budget neutrality and those type of elements in it at this point in time, because we have to. That's part of the negotiation with CMS. But the amendment is online.
Okay. And Valencia, the time frame still is aiming for April 1st, 2012. That's correct.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mark,
that's hard-coded in the New York State statutes. So, you know, we have no flexibility on that. That's what the legislature passed, April 1, 2012. So, I mean, one point that Valencia made, I think we should amplify, is we're still working on the final approval of the October 1 changes, which is Saturday. So these things are done sequentially with CMS.
To the application,
no, changes that are being implemented on Saturday, as far as the mainstream managed care program. So we have not talked like almost at all to CMS. They read the statutes and stuff, but there's been no discussion with CMS until we get to the next phase. There's nothing effective December, so April is the next phase. So we're very at the very beginning point with our discussions. Very beginning point was discussed with CMS on this change.
Mark, just a question. I appreciate that April is a very cruel month, you know, in terms of the implementation of what needs to be done. But there's an assumption that all of these things are going to occur with April being the implementation and rollout phase. I mean, what's the plan if the feds don't move at the same speed and you don't get the waiver approvals on the timetable that you're looking for, because there are predicated savings that's related to a process of enrollment, and that would change the whole picture in terms of what can be accomplished?
So the prognostication or the speculation game is something I'm not good at. I would be working down the street a little bit here at Wall Street if I was. You know, we are constantly reevaluating things as far as, you know, the savings go and how we're implementing different options. The difference in this year's budget was the legislature gave put a cap on the state share of Medicaid, which is a very unique thing, very big change that was enacted as part of the budget this year. So the division budget will not approve spending over the cap. So every day assumptions change about when we negotiated the budget. So we are working actively with the Medicaid director on all these, like, thousands of different initiatives that are happening. Some are being delayed, some are being moved up. But if we do not get a federal approval, we cannot move forward. So we'll have to check in, you know, almost later in the process before we can really answer your question, Eli.
Okay. So I think what I'd like to do is, if we don't have lunch yet, we will just continue and move towards discussion of the principles. And let me just, our goal is to adjourn no later than 2 p.m. We were asked by a few people who have holidays and other things that could we try to make sure that we adjourn earlier than 4 p.m., and we're going to try our utmost to adjourn no later than 2 p.m. So I just want to notify the work group that the whole MRT is meeting next week on October 5th, and we're supposed to give a report on our preliminary recommendations. There's a report that we have to begin to do, which will be due in mid-October. And then there's another MRT meeting, I believe, on November 1st. So we have to begin to move to provide our recommendations, and that will involve two that we talked about, the principles, as well as some key things that should guide us during the transition. So in regard to the principles and where we are, I was going to ask Jim to speak to that.
Okay. As you know, as we discussed at the hearing, unfortunately, we're not hear a lot about the principles themselves. Did not hear a lot about the principles, but instead heard a lot about people's concerns, so it was left us to try and translate those into
can't get back in once you're out.
No, that was Valencia trying to get back in. So it was, you know, left us to try and
translate what modifications to principles might be appropriate. We did, however, receive information from Home Care Associate, well, combined group. I don't know, it was Home Care and CCLC and NIOSHA, or a combined group with some modifications to principles. I don't know if you've gotten those.
Back tomorrow
around. Okay.
Home Care and NIOSHA, HCP and Adult Day Health Care Council, and I think CCLC was submitted separately.
Just an extra copy. My best, they may not have enough.
Does someone not have a copy? Oh, they're coming.
So I missed the discussion about lunch, but we assume we're breaking sometime soon. So, you know, it might be worthwhile to look at these over the lunch break, and then if we want to come back, and we can talk about them. But I think the what they trigger a useful discussion that might be triggered from the revisions here is, you know, what we're trying to accomplish with the principles. My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong here, is that the statutory direction for the development of managed care and care management alternatives to the current fee-for-service plan set out an opportunity for the development of alternatives to the managed long-term care program and PACE program that could be approved by the Commissioner of Health. And what we were trying to do with the principles was to set out a set of principles that would both inform any modifications to that would inform modifications to the managed long-term care plans, to the PACE programs, and also be the framework for consideration by the offer a framework for consideration by the commissioner in as to whether additional models should be approved. So I think, and I certainly appreciate where the long-term home health care program is coming from, but the simple incorporation of another program in the principles isn't really, I think, what we're intended to achieve with the principles. We're not intended to say, well, this program or that program is the model that the commissioner should approve. What we're trying to do is say, well, if the commissioner were going to approve additional models, what would their characteristics have to be? So I prefer to keep it at a sort of a generic level. There are obviously important questions that are raised in the revisions provided by the group of providers that worked on these principles, and I think a good number of them can be incorporated in, but I do think we need to proceed avoiding sort of reaching out and saying, well, Adult Day Health Care Program or Long-Term Health Care Program or the CHOP program is by definition what we're including in the care management coordinating care models or care management models of care. Any questions about that, or is that an agreeable way to proceed?
Are there any questions of Jim on what he's just posited?
I'd like to make a comment on it.
Go ahead.
If that's all right, Jim.
And again, I bring my own perspective to it, so I'm not advocating anything for the group here. But I feel very strongly about it, having been one of the first long-term home health care programs in New York State, and having been part of this 32 or 33-year process, it's time for a change. And I think the question is whether or not long-term home health care programs as an entity meets a care-coordinated model as defined by law. Not that they're not care-coordinated entities, because I think that one of the best care-coordinated entities in the state is the long-term home health care program. I think they've been working at it for over 30 years, and they have the expertise to do what needs to be done to manage care. But if the state moves in a direction for coordinated care entities that requires risk with reserves and structure that is different from the way in which long-term home health care is operated, it would seem to me that you could still continue the long-term home health care program as a program under contract with MLTP, TCPs, or other care-coordinated entities for those scope of services that don't necessarily include long-term care, that the risk for the long-term care piece still remains with the MLTCP, and that whether you call it bundled payment or contracted payment or however you want to go ahead and scope out the services, there's nothing that stops the long-term home health care program from continuing. But it's up to the state to determine whether they want to change the framework for coordinated care entities relative to reserves or anything else that they want to do in that regard. And you have to transition towards that as an ultimate goal of meeting what the new integrated systems are of care, which is different than what we had in 79 going through until 2011.
In this particular case, or among the rare case where I happen to have been there, so I have a pretty good understanding of the intent here, when the legislature was passed, I think the idea was that we do have the insurance model, and that insurance model carries a lot of complications with it, and that valued providers may not be comfortable with the insurance model, and would it be possible for us to explore an alternative route other than the insurance model to achieve the same objectives that we were trying to achieve with the more traditional models? And the answer to that was yes. We opened up a possibility to do that. And that, I guess, will be ongoing as long as the principals authorize that or provide for that opportunity. And I'm not sure reserves, which tends to be an insurance type of requirement, is necessarily something that we have to capture in the principals. But I think the risk is something that quite clearly was intended to be assigned or transferred from the state to the intermediary agencies that were being envisioned. And again, it's just a sense of what else needs to be in those principles in order for whatever the program is out there that might be created by the, either exists or might be created by the legislature to conform to the intent of the policy change that was enacted in March or in April.
Jim, in addition to the transfer of risk from the state to the entity, are there any other sort of core parts of the legislation that we should just be mindful of?
Well, clearly, I think accountability for the full long-term care spectrum, the opportunity to integrate with Medicare or with the acute care service in the future.
Okay. All right. Betty and then Joanne.
I guess it's a question and maybe naive.
because from my experience, there's never been a regulation New York didn't love, and so every time you turn around, there's new regulations, and you try to figure out how in the world can you deliver service under these regulatory environments. And, you know, we're saying that adult day and long-term home health care are not prescriptively in the care coordinating process, but is there a chance that you create this care coordination entity that can then go contract with non-licensed providers or that don't meet other kinds of standards? I'm just trying to, and I don't want to create more rules and regulations, but just trying to understand what the prospects are.
Again, I think that's a valid question as to what does a provider network have to look like for these plans? Should they be all licensed entities? Or I guess in the real world it's not possible, but which services have to be delivered through licensed entities? It's within the scope of the charter of this work group, I think, to address that type of question.
Okay, Joanne, you were next.
I guess I'd like to maybe step back a little bit, because one of the things that I keep asking myself is, maybe goes to Eli's question, what is it in the care coordination model that you're trying to accomplish? And once you decide that, then I think you might be in a position to say, can the long-term home health care program or adult day actually raise their own bar of performance to achieve those components of care coordination, and to what extent are they willing and able to take on some element of risk that goes beyond the traditional fee-for-service basis? To me, that is the core question about allowing an entity or entities who have provided services in many of our communities for thousands of people over several decades now to understand what it would be the expectation for them if, in fact, they wanted to be considered a care coordination model. I don't feel that I have fully grasped in my own head, maybe it's my own density, about what it is the state's looking for clearly in terms of the components of that care coordination, and then challenge the long-term programs and the adult day to say, can you, in fact, meet those expectations? And are you willing to do it under some kind of more risk-based model? That's where I have, it's a chicken and egg.
And, you know, and it's sort of frustrating to us, too, because I think it's exactly what we've been trying to say or trying to articulate, that we are at, I think that the statutory design and intent was to provide for a comprehensive array of services covering the entire array of Medicaid-funded services, and to transfer financial accountability or responsibility from the state to that entity, that intermediary entity. And those were the two essential components. As I've indicated, I think it implied in some part by the state statutory design, but also I think desirable because of federal interest, is the opportunity to achieve an integration between long-term and acute care services.
So back to you, Joanne. Does that help? You know, if we, our first principle right now was that a CCM must provide or contract for all Medicaid long-term care services in the benefit package. That was number one. And the second part of that was that this entity, the CCM, will be at risk for all the services in the benefit package, and the rates would be adjusted to reflect that risk. So that's our number one principle, which kind of captures what Jim was saying was the intention of the state policymakers.
I am dangerous, because I've drafted legislation in the past, as many of you know. So when I say the words that says the managed long-term care plan may, not shall, may also cover primary care and acute care if so authorized.
to me, that says is really contrary to what I'm hearing as the mandate here. So that's where I think I have some disconnect. Now, I was not involved in the room when the legislation was negotiated, so I can't speak clearly to the intent, but when I look at language, it does raise in my mind whether or not the intent was to be that fully. And if you, you know, if you go through some of the other provisions, certainly the indication was they wanted to start with long-term care services, which was defined as home, community-based and institutional. So that I get. It's a quantum leap that I'm not sure, unless I'm reading the legislation incorrectly, that is clearly identified as the intent. So I guess, Jim, you and I are on a different page about what, how comprehensive and when and how and what for.
Well, I think that language specifically was intended to cover PACE programs. But,
I don't know. Again, I'm not here. I'm only reading what I read in bill language.
Okay. So, does anyone want to kind of deal with this issue of the legislative intent?
Yeah.
Hold on 1 second, I'm just
going to
go to Mark.
I mean, legislative intent, I was in the room, so it was probably late at night. You know, it's always a foggy room to be in. But clearly, I think the overriding principle, as Jim articulated, was that all long-term care services should be, you know, in the benefit package, and that the care coordination model guidelines, which the department has to put out by November 15th, which this group is helping design, is that it's all long-term care services. There is an aspirational goal, clearly, of fully integrated acute and long-term care services. The federal government is very interested in New York participating in, you know, fully integrated plans in a major way. So we have partial capitation programs now. We will continue to have them. But the goal, frankly, is to get to full integration. I mean, that's clear. The law does say may. I think the goal was to try to, over long term, get to full integration.
Well, I mean, I suppose we could proceed down the line where we think that Medicaid Medicare integration is not something that ought to be achieved. But then there's going to be two managed care plans that the individual will be enrolled in, and that is cumbersome, I would think, that coordinating between those two plans. But quite clearly, I think the legislation was intended to point to PACE, to MLTCPs, and to hold out the possibility for designing an alternative to those if it could be done in a way that met the same program objective.
Okay, let me just try to finish this up, because I don't want to shortchange Joanne and sort of her chance to articulate her concerns.
I think the only thing, and I really don't want to belabor this, certainly I understand the goal and the intent. I don't think that's what we're debating. I think what we're debating right now is the ability to move towards that maybe ultimate goal over some period of time, but not necessarily to be there on day one. And in fact, if my recollection serves me correctly, almost all the MLTCs, setting aside PACE right now, are partial capitation. So they do meet, Mark, your statement of long-term care services. It's the quantum leap that I think is questioning how a long-term home health care program might exist in the future if you automatically assume you have to go to a full Medicaid benefit package and not just the long-term care benefit package. And that's why I keep pushing at this issue, because I think there is a value of saying the existing providers who have a relationship should be given at least the option of continuing that relationship, albeit potentially under a different payment mechanism. And that, to me, is a quantum difference. And so that's why I keep harping on this issue about whether the principles are going further than was, at least in my reading, of the options presented in the legislation.
Okay.
Well, let me back up one more step here. I mean, we were sort of trying to develop policy within the framework of a fiscal imperative. And I don't think at the end of the day, you know, if there was not a fiscal imperative, everybody wouldn't have appreciated the opportunity for more time. But that fiscal imperative was really driving us to the question, do we cut provider rates? Or do the other types of budget balancing things that have been done in the past? Or do we try and achieve the necessary financial targets through the redesign of the system? And it was the latter course that was chosen, and I'm the first to agree that that has put us on an accelerated pace that is uncomfortable for everybody. Certainly the health department just as much as providers and consumers. But once again, the backdrop of this was the necessity to bend the cost curve on Medicaid in a way that was not going to injure people or lead to limits of, you know, in access to service.
Okay, I'm going to, Alan, you were next, then Marilyn, and then David.
And Joe's before me, actually.
Oh, sorry, Joe, and then David. Go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't want to intervene in the debate between Joanne and Jim, but and I wasn't in the room, as many of you were, but having been in the program from inception, we understood that the imperative was to cover the package, which was in the statute that we originally began to operate under. We also understood, and Mark used the word aspirational, I think it's a great word, that the intent or the hope, the aspiration, was that when, as, and if it were possible to fully integrate, whether it was mandatory or not, but when it was possible to do it, that would be a desirable goal. A number of us have both programs, the partial cap and the full cap. We understood in the change, like I understood in the change, in the legislative change, in the recent one, that the return to allow partial cap when that had been off the table for a period of time was to permit greater flexibility to help other programs accommodate this kind of rapid change. And everyone has said the change is rapid. It's painful. It's painful for all of us. But the fiscal imperatives really do, and I don't want to argue the state side, but they really do mandate and necessitate change. The other programs, and certainly I advocate for the ADHD proposal on their unbundling, and I'm going to raise that again later. I supported their proposal. I've had numerous discussions with them. I think to the extent that other programs can either transition or subcap or play some role, I think that's a desirable goal. But I think to abandon the basic principles that the statute articulates would be a mistake.
Okay, thank you. Marilyn.
I think we're putting the cart before the horse. Who, what, where, what the entity looks like, what do we want? What are our principles? And then based on when we have a set of agreed principles, then it calls into place who could be a player or who should be a player. Until we have laid out the principles and identified them and agree with them, it's kind of, you know, it's premature because you don't know what they are. So how do you know who could or who couldn't?
Okay. Joe.
Okay. Practical issue before I come back to the policy issue. One of the things we've talked about is the importance of continuity of care. The importance of knowledge of the people we're trying to serve is fundamentally important. So one of the realities we have right now is programs in place that as of April have no longer have a reimbursement mechanism, are part of a delivery system that doesn't have tremendous excess capacity, I don't think. And so we need elements of that delivery system. Come back to the policy issue. Right now, I think we only have the existing managed long-term care programs, that's the only institutional entity we have that meets the care coordination principles as currently drafted, correct?
What
MLTCs are the only organizations that currently meet the care coordination, the CCM principles as, right, I'm sorry,
generically MLTC PACE, MLTC MAP, et cetera. But that's it. They're the only ones. One of the things we've glossed over a couple of times, but I think there are even some regulatory issues there, is whether these other programs can be part, can contract with them, with managed long-term care organizations. So I think if I understood a conversation I had with Linda a few weeks ago, the Lombardi programs right now can't turn around and contract to provide care, provide their services through an MLTC because there's some regulatory issue there. I think we should, if people agree, we should acknowledge that we need to make whatever regulatory changes we need to make so that the adult daycare programs, the Lombardi programs, who don't choose to pursue this CCM, whatever it turns out to be, so that they have that as an opportunity, because, in fact, we need them in the delivery system. We need to be able to continue to provide services. So then I think that the issue boils down to, is there another way to structure reimbursement for services? And when I think about it, we talk about risk, we talk about a variety of things. My understanding of the intent of the legislation is about getting our arms around all of long-term care services, assuming full responsibility for managing them within a budget. That's as fundamental as it gets. And so the question then becomes, does a bundle payment or, you know, does it accomplish that goal? I think we have the aspiration of ultimately dual integrated programs. I personally, obviously, given where I come from, that makes perfect sense. But I think, at least for programs that are not PACE, not MAP right now, the notion is to arrange for those other services, not necessarily have the financial responsibility for them. So then it boils down to, is there a reimbursement mechanism that works if, and I agree, keeping it generic makes sense because we don't know what else might emerge in terms of organizational forms. But then it's about, can we create a different reimbursement mechanism? I think that's really the heart of the issue. And I think there is a proposal worth looking at.
Well, I don't think we can or ought to create that reimbursement mechanism here. It's sufficient that we open the possibility for it. But I think you've stated exactly correct in all respects.
Okay, David?
I think my problem up to this point is I'm reading a document in French and I'm reading it in German. There's something that doesn't fit for me, and I guess I want to ask a broad question about the principles themselves. Is, are they being written for the CCM, or are they being written for the consumer? Because they, I guess that's my first question.
If I could, you know, I would, I am thinking that the MLTC P program as it exists today will have to be modified in some respects to conform to the principles that are recommended through the MRT process. I think if we look at the contracts today, the MLTCP contracts, they may not have all the explicit ideas that are incorporated in these principles.
So, I mean, the point of the principles is to do what? I go back to what Marilyn was asking. What is the point of having a bundle of principles? It's to guide who? The consumers who want to make sure they're getting what has been promised in the law, or the CCM who is trying to live up to what the expectations of them is?
I mean, I'll tackle that, but people can amend it. The way I look at it is it's really laying out for all of the stakeholders what the requirements are to become this new designated CCM long-term care entity. And so it informs those who want to become the entity what they would be required to do, existing, you know, MLTCPs or others, what changes they would have to make, and consumers who or beneficiaries who will become enrolled in these potentially. So I look at it as having a broad audience.
It feels to me like it's not written from the consumer perspective as much as it is from the provider perspective. And that may be just an issue of somebody with a really sharp editing pen. But there's a lot of, and I don't, there's a lot of things about including the family and including the beneficiary, which this should be, they should be the first person in the room, not just kind of an add-on. Well, and it's just the language, some of the language, and while I'm talking about language, there just seems to be, we talk about individuals, we talk about consumers, we talk about members. I mean, there seems to be a lot of, are they all the same person? And if they are, we should be using consistent language in the principles for clarity.
But that's exactly why we're here.
Right.
Well, is to fix those.
So my recommendation is that we use consistent language throughout the principles.
All right.
Okay.
Mr. McNally, we're
yes.
going to give you a job.
Uh-oh.
At some point today, we're going to ask you to take these principles and recast them in a way that you think works from a consumer
okay.
perspective, right?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. Just one last thought is, and this kind of goes to what Joanne was asking, I think, and again, for consistency purposes, though, when you read through the principles, you see a lot of cans, musts, shoulds, and mays. And I again think we need to figure out which are which, or are they all the same, and then who's actually responsible to, I don't know, do you enforce principles? I mean, who's actually going to say you have to do X and you're not doing X? Who, would that be the Department of Health, or what would be the system for holding people accountable to the principles? Right.
I don't know more.
Yeah, I mean, principles will be foundation for guidelines. Guidelines may or may not flow into regulation, and then as the entity responsible for all this stuff, the Department of Health, in conjunction, if we have to, with the Department of Financial Regulation or Insurance, will be the state that enforces all that and makes all this stuff happen. Now, with the overlay of CMS. So.
The objective is to get it right here, to create a system that works. And so the input, that's you know, the foundation of the stakeholders process is to make sure that we have an opportunity to hear from all stakeholders.
And my last comment is, going back to what the HCA and NASA and adult aid, I understand your point about not specifying it's going to talk of social adult and long-term. I understand. But I do wonder if the principles can't be drafted. So, I mean, would you agree that the principles as drafted essentially limit consumer program options to a single program structure? That's what they say in this document. And if it does do that, is that the intent? And if it doesn't do that, then perhaps we need to revisit the language, not with specific instances of who's going to qualify, but some sort of broad statement that doesn't do what they're suggesting these principles currently do. Or is that the intent of part of long-term care managed care?
Going back to when this language was drafted in the legislation, there was an opportunity to specify managed long-term care programs as the only model.
Okay.
We chose not to take that opportunity at that point, but to create an opportunity to design something else that we couldn't imagine at that time.
Okay.
It was open then, it remains open
right
now.
And I guess I'm sorry, Joe, I'm just, so if that is the case, then they are either, they believe it's currently written that that's not the case. Is that what I'm understanding from their letter? That the principles essentially limit consumer program options to a single program structure, and that was not the intent of the law. Is that correct? So
It's not that it limits it
to a single program structure. It's a structured type.
Right.
And that's a very big difference. A structured type is a coordinated care entity that meets certain levels of the principles that were set forth. If you run a program that only does limited activity and doesn't take full risk for everything that's supposed to be on the long-term care side, then you're inconsistent with the principles. So you either have to come up with a different payment mechanism to reflect that and identify the program as being another program that's outside the principles. And I don't think that's what the intent is. It's perhaps what would be liked, but not necessarily what we're moving to.
Okay, Carol, you were next.
I'm feeling very conflicted here because on the one hand, I agree that the principle, we should start with what we want to have happen, and those principles should guide it. But I think there's a subtext here, and I think, Betty, your question was very important because we're trying to accommodate a variety of program models, and I'm going to refer to them as capacity right now. So we don't have sufficient capacity today to try to do this without what's been put in place over 30 or more years. We have to consider that, all right? So the question of can you contract, is there any limitations on who we contract with if we are one of these CCMs? And assuming Principle 1 and 2 stay in place, then what are the prohibitions for working with any of these programs? Or is the real question on the table, are we going to have two classes of organizations, one that has risks and one that doesn't?
You know, again, if you read through the principles, and in the principles there's no prohibition against contracting, then there is no prohibition against contracting.
Okay. Kathy?
Well, I just had a question about that because somebody referenced before that there was a restriction about contracting, and I'd just like to clarify what that is because I don't recall it.
Is there a restriction now that long-term home health care programs can contract with managed care entities?
We haven't permitted long-term home health care programs to contract with managed long-term care plans because the long-terms have their own set of rules as to, you know, the 75% cap and the local district joint assessment. So we've not permitted that to this point.
But there's nothing in the regulations, excuse me, there's nothing in the regulations that precludes long-term home health care programs from contracting with a managed long-term care entity if they arrange for what that payment method is. There's nothing that says in the long-term home health care regulations that you cannot contract, at least my understanding of it.
I think, though, that the only thing we would, you know, long-term home health care programs exist under a 1915C waiver. So we would have to amend that waiver in some aspects in order to, you know, allow for the flexibility.
Again, if we need to seek waivers, if we need to seek regulatory change, if we need to produce guidelines that are going to bring us to the desired state, then that's what the health department will do. It's the intent here. Again, we set out a new policy with a broad statutory framework. We said we were going to, the MRT was going to undertake an effort to define that policy, to bring it into specific recommendations in order to carry it out. That's what this process is. So if it's desirable to allow managed long-term care plans to contract with adult day health care programs or long-term home health care programs, even if it means long-term home health care programs are going to have to be amended in some fashion, then that's the path that we would follow.
I need a point of clarification because I'm really confused. As an MLTC, we contract with facilities, a daycare, adult day, social day, whatever, and it's a contractual agreement at a red state. So there is a mechanism already for doing this. Am I right or am I right?
Yes.
That's not changing.
That's for adult day.
For adult day.
That's not my part, so.
I understand that. So if you talk, if can you then in some kind of amendment to the waiver or anything, look at one of the other programs, Lombardi or something like that, and say, well, we can contract them to do A, B, and C. Not the whole package, but what A, B, and C is.
Okay. All right, Joe, you had your hand
up. So I think we should pursue that waiver. I think we may actually be closing in on something, though I think it might be hard to recognize. I want to go back to something I heard Jim say a couple of times, and partly in his initial comments. We're focused on some issues we need to work out right now, given the April deadline. But what I also heard Jim articulate, which I sort of didn't realize before, is these principles are really not only for now, they're for the future. We are very, very early in Medicaid reform and in healthcare reform. And so these are principles that also create the guidelines by which the state would evaluate a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, or maybe the programs that would come out of some of the state planning grant work, or ideas that others would come up with down the road for new ways of doing this, so long as it meets the principles. So I think if we were all agreed that the issue really is responsibility for a sort of spectrum of services under a budget, that's I think the fundamental issue. Then the question becomes, how does one go about proposing and applying for and reviewing and get approval to bring a new program into being? And that's obviously, I agree, not this committee to sort of sit and work all of that out. But if everybody agrees on that, I think that's really
right,
the issue.
So let's just stop here. I mean, what Joe is saying is that a cardinal principle is that we're saying that a new long-term care entity will be responsible for a comprehensive set of services within a budget. That's a key. If anyone has issues with that, we want to flush that out right now.
Well, does that mean an individual path?
We're not going to...
I think
I think
and
the other principle we had in here was that payment should be risk adjusted, and we had a number of parameters having to do with functional assessments and other characteristics that would guide how the payments were risk adjusted. So I would say within a risk adjusted payment rather than a budget. Okay? So comprehensive spectrum of services within a risk-adjusted payment system. Okay. Okay. Joanne, take it away.
Define comprehensive range of services, because that's the nut that I'm having a hard time figuring out. If it's long-term care services, I get it. If it's all Medicaid services, I got concerns about it.
Okay.
And
fair enough.
So we need to define it.
Well, I think the law is clear. It's going to be the entire array of Medicaid services. Now, for this particular purpose, we're limiting ourselves to long-term care services. But we've anticipated in here the option of that same entity providing other than long-term care services. But we ought to be clear that if this entity doesn't provide the other Medicaid-covered services, some other managed care entity will.
All right. Right now, the way we have the principle is Medicaid long-term care services. That's what we have right now in the principle.
And so just to be clear, those are the services currently covered by MLTC partial cap plans. That's the suite of services we're talking about. And then, yes, they can arrange for coordinate other services, but don't have the financial responsibility for those.
Okay. Any other comments on that cardinal principle? Okay. Now, I don't know whether it's from exhaustion or consent, but since there are no comments, I'm going to sort of capture that principle, and then I'm going to ask you to take a 17-minute lunch. It's a New York lunch once again, and then return at 1 o'clock. Thank you.
I'm going to go for it.